Civic Flame, a podcast where we take a deep dive into the U.S. Constitution and discuss how it is and is not working in our government today. As always, I'm your host, Amber Veo, professor of law and policy at Worcester State University. And we are joined today, interestingly enough, by a rather large doe who is trucking around my yard. And I'm a little nervous because she seems to be wanting to jump into my neighbor's yard, and they have an Australian shepherd who is very energetic. So that deer might make a friend real soon. As a reminder, aside from not being a biologist or anybody, zoologist or anybody who has anything to do with animal behavior, I am also not a lawyer. So when I talk about the law with you today, it's with a mix of application, history, sociology, and all of that jazz, not just about how you apply it. As we talked about in our last episode, judges and lawyers look at the law in a different way than the rest of us because, well, it's their job to look at the law, see how it's applied in the situation, make sure that's happening, or make sure there are penalties if it's not happening. That's a very different job than a job like mine, where we stand back and we look at how we got certain laws, whether certain laws have changed over time, what has made those things change, or how law is working to shape the lives of people. So as we get into Article 4 of the Constitution, that's going to matter because we get to some places where law and practice and law and society tend to look a little different. Any lawyers out there who want to come and do a guest spot, just let us know. In the meantime, grab a seat by the fire, your favorite copy of the Constitution. I recommend the National Constitution Center, and let's go. Now that we've completed our journey through all three branches of government with Articles 1 through 3, we're going to get into Article 4. Remember that the Articles of Confederation failed in part because it was unclear what the relationship between the states should be. States could print their own money, they could make their own foreign policy, and it wasn't clear how much they had to play nice with the other kids. Article 4 has four sections. For this week, we'll cover the first two, which really gets into what states owe each other. For next week, we'll cover the last two sections, which are a little bit more about what the federal government owes the states. Article 4, Section 1 starts with something that shapes your daily life. The Full Faith and Credit Clause. It says, "Full faith and credit shall be given in each state to the public acts, records, and judicial proceedings of every other state, and the Congress may by general laws prescribe the manner in which such acts, records, and proceedings shall be proved, and the effects thereof." Now, there are some caveats here. States don't have to follow every law. Primarily, they have to just follow some civil laws. Civil laws are things that you don't go to jail for if you break them. So if you're jaywalking, you may be breaking the law, you may be doing something illegal, but you're not a criminal because you're not actually committing a crime. Why? Because the penalty for jaywalking is administrative, like a ticket or a fine, which makes it civil law. Versus the penalty for running over a jaywalker is criminal because it goes into the criminal justice system and you go to prison. But there are also public policy things that states don't have to agree on. So let's get into some of this. Full faith and credit applies to public records like birth certificates, death certificates, marriage licenses, high school diplomas, and so on. This is why if you have a driver's license in one state, it's valid in another state. Don't get me started on real ID and why I think it's an infringement on our liberties. Now, typically, it is states that get to decide a lot of these public policy things. As we'll talk about later, particularly with the 10th Amendment, this has a lot to do with states' rights, which gives states legal jurisdiction over things related to health, education, and morals. And basically, if it's not power that the government has, and it's not power that the states have, it's power that the people have. The one rule is nothing can conflict with the Constitution. So as long as those rules don't violate the Constitution's protections on equal protection under the law, due process, and so on, you can do pretty much anything else. As we're dealing with these kind of things, remember, it's not just about what the law requires or forbids. Those things are pretty obvious. But there's also what the law allows, and that's a lot of what we're working with. The law requires states to give full faith and credit to each other's public documents, but it allows a lot of discretion in there. Marriage is a particularly salient example. No-fault divorce wasn't legal in all 50 states until 2010, and there are many politicians now trying to get rid of it. But divorce in general also has been in a legally tangled area where different states have different requirements, residency, proof of infidelity or abuse, and so on. Before divorce was accessible in all parts of the U.S., people would go to Nevada, where divorce was a much quicker process. For example, you had to live in Massachusetts for about 5 years before you could apply for a divorce, where in Nevada, I think it was closer to just 6 months. So off to Nevada people would go. They'd stay there long enough to get residence and then file for divorce. Once the divorce went through, they'd go back to their home state. And because of the full faith and credit clause, the states would have to recognize the divorce in the same way that Nevada had to recognize the marriage. Today, this is still the case and can be complicated by custody battles, probate court, and so on, but ultimately the fundamental documents and legal status of married or divorced is fairly the same. One of the key features of the marriage equality argument was that if any state recognized marriage between same-sex couples, then other states had to recognize the marriage license. To me, a constitutional radical, this is a clear argument. The government doesn't get to tell people who they get to marry. I don't care who or how many consenting adults you want to marry, though most states do ban polygamy or marriage to multiple partners. As long as everybody is a consulting adult, for me, ideally over the age of 24 or 25, when that prefrontal cortex is fully developed, if you're all cool with it and non-abusive to each other, what's it to me how many of you want to get married? But states claim the 10th Amendment police powers gives them the right to shape what they see as morality. And this becomes a conflict with that full faith and credit clause with regards to marriage equality. In 2015, the Supreme Court case Obergefell v. Hodges fell pretty clearly on the side of full faith and credit and equal protection under the 14th Amendment and said, if two consenting adults can get married, then any two consenting adults can get married, and it doesn't really matter what gender they are. But the areas of public policy and criminal law that are not always included in full faith and credit can also be thorny. So if you think about things that really only affect an individual, to people like me, it's very weird when the government wants to get in there and say who gets to do what. But we have a lot of that at the states. So marijuana and euthanasia, for example, are legal to varying degrees across the country. Some states have medical marijuana legalized, others have recreational marijuana, others have none. Likewise, some states have policies that completely forbid euthanasia, others have physician-assisted suicide, others have more non-physician-assisted suicide. These are all possible under the flexibility of full faith and credit that maintains our federalism, where each state has its own character, rules, moral and policy codes, and all also while saying that there are times when we are one country, right? So when it comes to individual behavior, things that states have a way to deal with, we're 50 states. When it comes to things that we need to function, like our driver's license, we're one country, and you have to respect everybody's license. While this is theoretically a what do states owe each other question, remember that it is also a freedom of movement question. If your high school diploma stopped, or your driver's license doesn't work anymore, or your valid marriage license is void once you cross state lines, that would seriously restrict your right to live, work, and sometimes even visit wherever you wanted. So full faith and credit exists to make states play nice with each other, but states playing nice with each other exists for the benefit of all of the people and our ability to live peaceably in our own country without fear of being targeted because one state government doesn't like the state where we're from. This gets into Section 2 of Article 4, the Privileges and Immunities Clause. Section 2 starts with, The citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several state. This is a fancy way of saying that states can't discriminate against you based on your state of origin. So if you live in New Jersey but work in New York, New York can't pay you less or forbid you to work there. You have the right to work wherever you're hired and be treated just like anyone else. Now, there are some variations on this when jobs are letting people work online and there's questions about cost of living, but that's a very specific type of law. Likewise, if you stop someone from speeding on the interstate, you can't charge them more because they're from out of state. You can't forbid out-of-state residents from taking the bar exam or going to state colleges. Interestingly, you can charge out-of-state residents more for state college tuition. This is not considered discriminatory because state colleges and universities are funded by taxpayers. The idea here is that you or your family has paid into the pool of money, so you get the benefit of low tuition. Speaking of state schools, Worcester State has low tuition and some pretty good deals for out-of-state students, so if you're cool and you want to come hang out with me, check us out, because Privileges and Immunity says you can come live here and learn here, and we can't discriminate against you. But if you're convicted of a crime in your own state, don't come here because we can't do anything about that and help you. We have to send you back. How do we know? The second part of Article 4, Section 2. A person charged in any state with treason, felony, or other crime, who shall flee from justice and be found in another state, shall, on demand of the executive authority of the state from which he fled, be delivered up to be removed to the state having jurisdiction of the crime. This is what is known as extradition. For example, if someone commits a crime in Florida and runs to Massachusetts to avoid the law, Massachusetts is required by Article 4 to send them back if Florida asks. Interestingly, this was not always something the court said they had the power to enforce. It wasn't until 1987 that the Supreme Court did rule that federal courts could order governments to comply with extradition orders. This is different internationally, and there are many countries that will not extradite someone charged with a capital crime to the U.S. This is because capital crimes are those that you can be sentenced to death for. Since a vast majority of countries in the world do not allow the death penalty, many of those also do not allow extradition of a person who might be subject to a death sentence. The final part of Section 2 is obsolete now. It says, no person shall be held to service or labor in one state under the laws thereof, escaping into another state shall, in consequence of any law or regulation therein, be discharged from such service or labor, but shall be delivered up on claim of the party to whom such service or labor may be due. This is known as the Fugitive Slave Clause. Remember, there were several instances within the Constitution that protected the institution of slavery. It was this original sin, as it is called, that led to our first Civil War. But this section is also really at conflict with that concept of states' rights, because if a state wants to refuse slavery, they can't. The Constitution says so. They have to be complicit in it by returning people who have escaped. It's worth noting that this clause, among other pieces of fugitive slave federal legislation, disproves on its face the argument that the South was fighting for states' rights during the Civil War. Northern states regularly tried to find legal ways around returning enslaved people who reached freedom, and the South regularly relied on the coercive power of the federal government to force northern states to return people to enslavement. It's one of the many problems with our historical narrative. Too often we have allowed the ideology to do our thinking for us, and in this case, the belief that the South was fighting for states' rights is exactly that. On its face, it's easy to see that it is nonsense, but never questioned because it just becomes how people view the world. When I moved to Texas for high school, I heard someone call it the War of Northern Aggression. As someone who'd been educated in Massachusetts, I reminded them that the South fired on Fort Sumter first, and they were pretty annoyed with me. But overall, this article really gets into several ways that are meant to help states with some general level of stability across states, both for the benefit of the citizens of each state and all people within the United States, but also to to help stabilize relationships among states by limiting areas where there are confusions, overlap, or places there might be resistance. Well, you'll be happy to know, for those of you who are still wondering, the deer left my yard, did not bother the dog, the dog did not bother the deer. Our other neighbor has some cows, and I believe they are all over there being rather large mammals together. But this was the first half of Article 4, and next week we'll hit you with the second half. Maybe there'll be a deer, maybe there won't. My daughter is putting peanuts and fruit out and trying to attract crows, so I'll keep you posted on how that goes. But in the meantime, follow us wherever you find your podcasts, as well as on Blue Sky, Instagram, and some Substack at Dr. Fun Sponge. Until next week, try to ease into the new year slowly. It's been a lot already. And keep the civic flame burning bright. And take care out there. The Civic Flame is a Dr. Fun Sponge media project made in conjunction with Amber Veo, writer, and sound producer Matt Munyon. Thanks for listening.